This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, my interview with Linda Seeley and Jane Swanson of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. They talk about their concerns related to Diablo Canyon and why they continue to advocate for its closure.
It's because of the large amount of highly radioactive nuclear waste that's being stored on this very vulnerable coastline.
Then, KCSU reporter Mavis Holly speaks to Megan Overland, who is part of the Santa Barbara Transgender Advocacy Network, about how allies can support the transgender community going forward.
You know, transgender people need a community. They need people supporting them more than we need, you know, any particular amount of money.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 24th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with an interview with Randy Widera, Director of Programs for California State Parks Foundation.
Hello, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Sam Doyle Jacobson, Programming Intern at KCBX. My guest today is Randy Widera, Director of Programs at the California State Parks Foundation, here to talk today about the monarch butterflies at Pismo Grove. Randy was recently quoted in a KCBX news story by Amanda Wernick, in which he spoke about the cause and effect cycle of climate change, habitat decline, and subsequent decreases in the populations of native species. Welcome to Issues and Ideas, Randy. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure to meet you and pleasure to be talking about the monarch butterflies.
So let's start with what you do at the California State Parks Foundation and how you ended up there.
So as the director of programs, we actually work with all 280 state parks across the state of California. Our programs involve, we do a statewide volunteerism program. So every weekend we have volunteers out pulling non-native plants, restoring monarch groves, and doing work all across the state. We also have a climate resilience program. So we're funding different projects up and down the state about building climate resilient parks. And we also fund equitable access. So we work with community groups, trying to get all folks into parks, enjoying parks, making them accessible to everyone. Then the foundation also does quite a bit of advocacy. So I spend some time up in Sacramento talking to legislators, working with legislators, and working on solutions that will help state parks so that they're enjoyed for everyone. I've been doing this for 30 years. I started my career working in outdoor education with kids and really understood the magic and the need that kids have for being outside. And from that, I really learned the value of our natural places. And I took kids to a lot of state parks, a lot of state parks here on the Central Coast, and realized that if I really wanted to make a difference, I had to find ways to really help these natural places. And so I've worked for all kinds of organizations that work with state parks and parks and environmental education. And for the last 5 years, I've worked with the California State Parks Foundation. I've taken all this knowledge and really enjoy working with the people in the Park Service as well as all the volunteers.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm a state parks fan myself, and I'm glad there's someone out there keeping them alive, so to speak. But I did want to talk about the monarchs at Pismo Grove. As most of our listeners will probably know, Pismo Grove is one of the overwintering locations for the monarch population who migrate from the south, and they stay in the eucalyptus grove at Pismo Grove. So, Randy, can you give us a background on the monarch butterfly and a little more specifics about its habitat and migration patterns?
First of all, I have the fortune of having worked with monarchs for the last 30 years. And so I can tell you stories of times when there were 200,000 monarchs in the grove. And so being able to enjoy them, and I think like everybody on the Central Coast, it's like fall time means monarchs, you know, and it sort of defines the season. A lot of people like to say that California doesn't have seasons, but definitely if you live along the coast and you live by a monarch grove like Pismo, you understand that fall time definitely has meant these incredible insects coming in droves. So many fascinating things to say about monarchs. First of all, their migratory behavior. There is five generations between the monarchs that are leaving now and the monarchs that will return next year in the fall time. So there's five generations. And so what happens is that the monarchs come here to overwinter because they love the coastline because of the moderate temperatures and these groves where that they can live for a long period of time, clustering in the groves and being protected by the wind, and we don't have those freezing temperatures. So that's one of the main things that's bringing them here. Then in February and March time, they start to migrate and mate, and they go out in all directions, but mostly towards the Central Valley, the Sierra foothills, up to Oregon, and all the way up to Washington. And they'll have successive generations. And so the monarchs that leave from here, they'll mate, they'll find milkweed. If you go along Highway 101, you'll see all these little milkweed patches. And so inland, they're looking for that milkweed, so a place where the female can lay her eggs. And then that generation, once they go through the larva, pupil, and then adult stage, will migrate maybe to the Central Valley or the Sierra foothill. And then they'll find a milkweed there. And so their whole migration not only depends on these overwintering sites, but they depend on the habitat that sustains milkweed all throughout California, Oregon, actually all the way to the Rockies. So when we say the Western monarch, it's the Western monarch population that we're talking about. There's also the Eastern monarch. And so those are the ones that actually migrate down into Mexico.
I am curious on long-term how Western monarch migration patterns change over time. The last time I was at Pismo Grove, I noticed the majority of the trees that the butterflies stay in are eucalyptus trees, which are not native to California. Right. So I was curious, like, what did they do so many hundreds of years ago?
Well, in California, we're about real estate, right? And it's all about location, location, location. And for monarchs, it's about location. So it's less about the eucalyptus trees, and it's very much about where the location is of the grove and how the grove is, how it looks. Because what the monarchs are looking in is just right off the coast, because that's where you don't get freezing temperatures. So they don't survive very well with the freezing temperatures. And they need a grove of trees that's open at one end so that sunlight can come in, but sheltered on the other ends so the wind protects them. These groves have a very unique complex that makes them suitable for monarchs. And groves can lose their elements that make it no longer good for a monarch. So if the Pismo Grove, say, were to lose a bunch of trees and the wind were to come through, the monarchs wouldn't stay there. So they're looking for that location. So they will overwinter in native pines or native willows if it's in the right location. And if there's a grove of those trees that have those certain conditions.
So the Pismo Grove just had those like perfect conditions, right, almost by chance.
Yes.
So the conservation nonprofit, the Xerces Society, conducted a count that found only 556 monarch butterflies at Pismo Grove in the 2024 overwintering season. This is a significant drop from last year, which saw population numbers of around 16,000. Can you provide some reasoning as to why the population took a dip?
We're finding out more and more about what's really affecting them. When you think about monarch population and migration, you're talking about a whole phenomena, right? And so there are several factors. And these are the things that we know about their populations. Number one is that when there is more increased temperatures or more severe storms, that can disrupt their migration patterns. We know that if we lose habitat, meaning if we change how we farm or how we utilize land and there's no more milkweed along their migratory stem, that will decrease populations. We also know that they're affected by pesticides. So climate change, habitat loss, pesticides, all of these can be factors. And then you have other factors, so wildfires. So a couple of years ago when we had the CZU complex fire up in the Santa Cruz Mountains area, if you have a lot of smoke from wildfires, that can disrupt migration patterns too. So sometimes that'll send monarchs to other locations. So you have these temporary things, and then you have these larger things that are affecting their population.
It's just so interesting that, like, they're a group of so many different insects, but they all somehow take in this information and act as one group.
It's astounding. And it reminds us that there's so much that we still don't know. You know, I think we pride ourselves as humans in a modern culture that we have so much knowledge, but really there's so much that we don't understand about the natural world. But by studying monarchs, we find out so much about the things that are affecting us. So the same things that affect monarchs, the climate change, extreme heat, extreme weather, it's something that we're all dealing with in terms of our own personal homes and our communities as well as statewide. But I think one of the things that's – here's a story that something that science just found out was that an individual monarch really can map the grove that it's overwintering in. So they've done studies now where a monarch will, you know, get out of its roost in the morning, the place where it's clustering. When it's 55 degrees, they start to warm up. And a lot of times what they're doing is they're looking for nectar sources, because even though they're overwintering, they're not hibernating, their bodies are still active. So they still need those nectar sources. So that monarch will come out of its cluster, and then it'll circle around the grove, and it can identify different trees, different landmarks. It can map the grove, so it knows where it is. And again, that's one of those things when you think about a 1 ounce little insect and you're like, oh, that, you know, that's an intelligence that that animal is having. That, and so you start to understand that they, as individuals, have understandings. They're able to take in their environment and take in knowledge, and then through their instincts and behaviors, understand that they need to make certain decisions to survive. So then you start to understand, like, oh, it's not just random, that they have instinct, they have a way to map and understand their environment, and they have an ability to sort of make decisions and to seek those preferable locations. And it's astounding to start to get into the mind of a monarch and to imagine all that they need to understand to be able to do this.
That is truly amazing. Thank you for sharing that. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Sam Doyle Jacobson with Randy Wadera, Director of Programs at the California State Parks Foundation, speaking about the decline of the monarch butterfly population. So if all trends continue, what can we expect for the future of the Western monarch butterfly?
Well, currently, the National Fish and Wildlife Service says that within 50 years, the Western monarch population will be extinct if we do not do something. And that's why they have proposed listing it as a threatened species. And currently, they're taking public comment about the listing of the Western monarch population. And it's important to understand that there's a Western population and an Eastern population. But all monarchs are actually really threatened. But they say that within 50 years, there's a 95% chance of them going extinct. So what does that mean? That means that continued stresses due to climate change, due to habitat loss, due to lack of overwintering sites is what's driving this. So the part that we're trying to do and take actions, the California State Parks Foundation, the Circe Society, the Central Coast Natural History Association, which is locally here working directly with parks, are all looking at ways in which we as groups and how individuals in their communities can start to take action to turn the tide on the monarch conservation.
So you said the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was accepting public comment. What does that mean?
So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is basically they're the folks that manage endangered species and endangered species recovery. So right now what they're doing is it's been proposed, and the Xerces Society 10 years ago had submitted this application to list and to add the monarch butterfly as a threatened species. So there's endangered species and there's threatened species, and it's different levels of priorities. So then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service then goes through a year-long process once they've decided to say, hey, we're going to look into listing this. What is the science behind this? And so that's what they're doing right now, and they're taking public comment. But then they also take all the best science and they look at the different considerations, because once you list a species, then you have all sorts of restrictions, and those restrictions can have impacts on a myriad of different organizations and individuals. So they want to make sure that when they're doing the listing, they do it correctly. But then specifically, this listing is what are the conservation efforts that are really going to make a difference? And one of the main ones that is called out is these overwintering groves. And these are a critical piece because if we lose these groves, then we lose the ability for them to have an overwintering site where they can survive the winter. And all sorts of things. I was just out talking to state parks folks and several who were on the Woolsey Fire down in Southern California. And that fire burnt down one of the monarch groves down there. And once you lose that grove until those trees come back and it matures, you've lost it forever. So there's all kinds of threats to these groves. So one of the things we're focused on is the grove management and protecting these groves.
So you talked a little bit about the impact that the environment and human actions have on the monarch population. Is there any impact the other way around? Like, is there any impact that comes from the decrease in the monarch population on humans and the environment?
Yes. First, I want to touch on the just nature is such an important part of who we are. We're part of nature. And monarch butterflies are such an emblematic species that most people can relate to and connect with. And so I think one of the biggest impacts that I know that monarchs have are just on people caring. And the idea of these are wonderful, beautiful animals. They're magnificent. They're inspiring. They're in our folk literature. They're in our modern literature. So one of the main, you know, effects that they have on us as a species is just this immense connection and caring. And they are a way for so many of us to enjoy more of nature and different species because, like I said, they're so emblematic. But they also are pollinators, and as do our bees and our other insects that are pollinators that make sure that our trees are pollinated, our plants are pollinated, our food is secure. Pollinators are really critical to not only the food we eat, but the other natural native species, the plants in your garden, all depend on these pollinators. And so that is one of the critical things. And as the monarchs go, so do our other pollinators. So by understanding about conserving monarchs, and by conserving monarchs, we're not only conserving the butterflies, but you're conserving the other pollinators who also use those host plants or who use nectarine plants to survive.
So besides listing the Western monarch as a threatened species, what are some steps that scientists are taking to combat the population decline?
So I think right now, the idea of what we call these grove management plans. So like I said, location, location, location. These groves, a lot of them are on public land and the vast majority on state park lands, which is one of the reasons why the foundation is so interested, because so many of these groves are on California state parks lands. Working with Xerces societies and organizations like the California State Parks Foundation is funding these grove management plans so that each one of these groves has a specific plan that will ensure that it has the right conditions for the monarchs to come over. That is one of the things that we understand that we can do that actually can conserve the monarchs and provide that location. But like I said, each grove is unique. It's not just a one size fit all. Each grove needs its own plan and actually needs its own set of actions. And then what we're learning is by just simple planting of nectar plants. We have a statewide volunteerism program, and there's a grove up in Santa Cruz called Lighthouse Field. And what our volunteers are doing there are pulling sort of non-native invasive species, but adding nectar plants. And so when the monarchs come, they have a food source. So definitely these what may seem like simple actions, but take a lot of person power, take a lot of thought, take a lot of planning, are one of the things that we're finding are having an impact. Then also looking as anyone who lives like 5 miles or more inland from the coast, planting those host plants like milkweed and native milkweed is a critical source because we can't have the migration if we don't have milkweed along the way. Scientists are learning more, like I said, and I think mostly these straightforward actions in conservation are what we're finding really does make a difference. What we don't understand is, and we don't understand this for so many species, is what will a warming climate do? And so our understanding right now with monarchs and with a warming climate is that these groves will be drier. So we have to make sure that these trees can survive, because drier groves means less healthy trees, maybe less healthy plants that are nectar source. So we're starting to look at, do we have the right plants planted? Do we have the right trees planted? These are all things to be still understood as the climate changes.
So there's lots to still understand, but there are some ways that even the average person can help by planting those nectar plants.
Absolutely. Everybody who has a garden, even if you have a terraced deck and an apartment, you know, those nectar plants, the butterflies will find them. And they're really great in seeing infrared. If you have never kind of had a chance to look at how insects see with their infrared, but those plants, and especially some of those nectar plants, they have a really good ability to pick those out.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
If people would like to find out more information about monarch butterflies or their state parks, they can go to www.calparks.org. That is the California State Parks Foundation website. Specifically, also, you can go to Xerces Society, xerces.org, to find out more about their work with monarch butterflies and monarch conservation. But I also invite people to go out to your state parks, talk to the state parks people. They're a wealth of knowledge, too. And if you are somebody who has extra time, they're always looking for volunteers. There's nothing more than being at the Pismo Grove and being a volunteer and welcoming people who will see their monarchs for the first time. Even if it's a small number, it's a magical experience. And yes, go out, enjoy your California state parks, and find out more what you can do to help.
Well, thank you for being here, Randy. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Sam Doyle Jacobson, programming intern at KCBX. I've been speaking with Randy Wadera, Director of Programs at the California State Parks Foundation. Thank you so much for being here today and taking the time to talk with me.
All right. Well, thank you. And I hope everybody gets a chance to enjoy the monarchs.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, my interview with Linda Seeley and Jane Swanson, board members of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace.
It's wonderful to meet both of you.
Thank you, Mayor.
It's good to be here.
Your About Us page mentions that Mothers for Peace, quote-unquote, organized in 1969. Why organize and not established?
We actually got together as the result of a letter to the editor of a young woman who lived in Los Osos and was opposed to the Vietnam War and feeling quite helpless as an individual. So she invited people to join her to form an organization to be more effective than an individual could be. So that's how it started, and that's why our name is Mothers for Peace. It makes sense there. And we were opposed to the war because it was illegal, immoral, and people were dying. And we were also opposed to the atmospheric weapons testing that was going on at that time because of the radioactive fallout. So it's very logical that when PG&E announced it was going to build a nuclear power plant, literally in our backyards, we quickly found out that the byproduct of fission in a bomb and the byproduct of fission in a nuclear reactor are, of course, exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want that radioactive waste being generated and stored and used on our coast. So that's how we got into opposing the Diablo Canyon plant.
That is interesting that you mention how the nuclear aspect of your work connects to you opposing the Vietnam War. So why is it specifically called Mothers for Peace?
Initially, when the group started, it was all young mothers with children. And of course, men are very welcome to Mothers for Peace. Motherhood is a state of mind, meaning someone who wants to protect the future generations. I think that I wasn't here at that time. I didn't move here till the early 80s. But I think they were looking for a good name for people opposing the Vietnam War. And they were moms who came together.
Yeah, I can speak to that, Linda. Yeah. It's accurate. I was there in 1969. I missed the very first meeting, and five people phoned me and said, Jane, these are your people. Get mm-hmm. over here. So I did. And by the third meeting, we had settled on Mothers for Peace, or San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. We wanted it clear that we were a local organization, not connected to chapters of something else. But yes, that described us quite accurately at that time. But we have always, through the 50-plus years, we've had men and non-parents involved with this. So we're not kicking out anybody else. Linda put it very well. Motherhood is a state of mind and an attitude. I've personally baked bread for and given it as a trophy and declared some male supporters to be mothers. We can baptize them as mothers, including Dick Crasa, who was That's on right. the city council and then the board of supervisors mm-hmm. many, many decades ago. He was the one environmental activist in elected office locally. So we officially made him a mother.
Okay. That's a nice story. Baked bread made him a mother. So in 1973, you start opposing the establishment of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Let's go back in time to that. What were the kind of conversations that you were having? Because as you mentioned, you had been opposing the Vietnam War and then you got the news. What was that transition like? What was the conversation?
Excellent question. It didn't take us long to realize that the Diablo Canyon plant sounded like a big threat to the environment. But we had to study a few years because I didn't know the word nuclear reactor when we first learned about it. We had to start from the beginning and study up. And none of us have PhD degrees. One of the very active mothers, Sandy Silver, her husband taught physics at Cal Poly. He understood nuclear. And so he gave us some mini lessons and explained what a nuclear power plant was. So we had to study for a while. And then we realized we need to be incorporated because we're going to have to hire lawyers. We're going to have to raise money. We want a nonprofit 503 status. We were fortunate to find a local lawyer who would, as a volunteer, we didn't have to pay him. He helped fill out the papers and get us our nonprofit status in 1973. And at that point, two of our very brave leaders, Sandra Silver and Elizabeth Apfelberg, they filed to become legal interveners with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Actually, I must correct myself. At that time, they had another name. It was the Atomic Energy Commission. They applied to be legal interveners, and they had to show standing. Standing meant you have to live within 50 miles of the threat that might do you harm. And that's why our membership is all local. We have to live within 50-mile wow. radius of the plant. So they filed both as individuals and as representatives of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, which was very far-thinking of them. They're not trained lawyers. They acted as our lawyers for about 5 years. Wow, that was something else. I mean, the Atomic Energy Commission would come to San Luis Obispo. It was a big deal, and they acted as lawyers for quite a few years. And then we got lucky. After 3 or 4 years of them acting as our attorneys, we went seeking, you know, qualified attorneys who were experienced with environmental and regulatory issues. And we found them in the Center for Law in the Public Interest, CLIPI, we called them. They were a fantastic organization based in Los Angeles. They were nonprofit. We did not pay their lawyers. We paid their expenses. We paid for a lot of paperwork. We paid for their travel. But we weren't paying them hundreds of dollars an hour because we didn't have any money at all at that time. The money we had to raise for the expenses, we had rummage sales. We had bake sales. We really did all those things. We wore ourselves out, but we made it through those early years, and we're still doing it.
Linda, could you share currently what your most important goals are, what actions you are advocating for, and the result that you want to achieve?
Okay. The result is simple. I'll say that first. We want Diablo Canyon to shut down. Unit 1 should have shut down in 24, Unit 2 should be shutting down in August of 25, but it's been given an extension, a life extension, through legislative action. The reason we want to shut the plant down is also very simple. It's because of the large amount of highly radioactive nuclear waste that's being stored on this very vulnerable coastline at Diablo Canyon that is intersected by several earthquake faults that are predicted by Mothers for Peace's very illustrious, qualified expert, Dr. Peter Bird, who is an emeritus professor of geophysics from UCLA, who's predicted that the possibility of an earthquake that would cause a radioactive release into the atmosphere is 47 times more than PG&E predicts. There's the nuclear waste that's there. While the plant is operating, which it is, two reactors are operating right now, if there were an earthquake, it could cause damage to the critical backup safety system. The domes wouldn't crack and fall down. But what we're concerned about is the supports, the backup safety systems, the piping, the intake structure, where the cooling water comes in that has to be running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, bringing in 2.5 billion gallons of water through that plant every 24 hours. When it comes in from the ocean, it's the temperature of the Pacific Ocean. When it goes out, being dumped back into the ocean, it's 19 degrees warmer than it was when it came in. So the heat inside that plant is tremendous. If, God forbid, there were a bad earthquake or other issue that would cause them to have to shut down the plant quickly, the way they shut down a plant quickly when it's running is that they pour cold water into the reactor vessel to bring it offline. I'm sure you've had the experience of putting a cold glass into boiling water and you've seen it shatter. That's the same effect as an embrittled nuclear reactor might experience if things didn't go well.
My follow-up question would be, when you're providing these facts to us about the dangers and the possibility of, you know, these kind of accidents happening, have you surveyed it independently, or what is the source of your information? Mm-hmm. And the other question is, when you were just mentioning the NRC and their particular statement about Diablo Canyon, is there a particular source that you can cite for that?
Yes. The source of the earthquake data is not the NRC's. That's PG&E's, okay? Our earthquake data is from our seismic expert. And we have taken this issue to the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee over the past year or so. And they are still in the process, along with what's called the Independent Peer Review Panel of the California Public Utilities Commission. They're earthquake experts, and they are still integrating the expert testimony that Mothers for Peace provided to them, I think, close to a year ago, about the dangers of the earthquake at Diablo. The IPRP, Independent Peer Review Panel, is formulating their final report right now. We don't know what that will be, but it will address the allegations that Dr. Bird has made about the inaccuracy of PG&E's estimate for the earthquake.
I'd like to add to Linda's excellent answer there. Regarding sources of our information, thank you for asking. None of the members of Mothers for Peace are experts in anything. We don't claim that. But we do hire the best experts. And we are very proud of our website. If you go to mothersforpeace.org and you want to know where we get our seismic data, just do a search for seismic data, or even better, Peter Bird. It's a seismic expert. And you can see all of his submissions. One is 86 pages long, another one is 8 pages long. So all of our expert witnesses and our attorneys' filings are available on our website. If you go to mothersforpeace.org, latest news, and then along the way, do your searches for whatever you want to know. Our data is solid as a rock.
Thank you, Jane, for addressing that. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali, talking to Linda Seeley and Jane Swanson of the nonprofit San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. So, as you just mentioned, one of your main goals is the closure of Diablo Canyon. But the plant employs thousands of people from the Central Coast. How do you respond to this?
Mothers for Peace has nothing against the people who work at Diablo Canyon. We appreciate them. The thing hasn't melted down, okay? They're conscientious. They're our neighbors. We do think that if you look at the big picture, the people who run a nuclear power plant could, no doubt, they're educated. They could get other jobs with renewable energy sources. And the local economy would be just fine and dandy by switching to renewables rather than Diablo Canyon. A nuclear power plant, in general, they don't employ as many people as the renewable energy industries. But those people would be just as unhappy as I would be if there were a meltdown. If there's that kind of a loss of control and a meltdown, there is no backup plan. This whole area and everything downwind for hundreds of miles would become uninhabitable for three generations. And that comes from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, not from Mothers for Peace.
Linda, I want to follow up with something that you said. You mentioned that we don't need Diablo Canyon to generate electricity. Could you expand on that?
Yes. You probably need to have a whole program about this because this is a very complicated thing. The fact, though, is that Diablo Canyon's operation restricts the renewable energy, the solar and the wind, from coming online when we have plenty of solar and wind, because Diablo Canyon is what they call a baseload power. You can't turn a nuclear plant off and on because the most dangerous time with that plant is during the shutdown and the startup. So what they have to do when we are producing so much wind and solar during the day in California is they restrict those resources onto the grid. But then people say, but there is this time between 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. when we need Diablo Canyon after the sun goes down and before the wind comes up. But now we have so much battery storage here in California that it makes up, it can store during the day using renewables, cranking up the power that's stored in the batteries. That power can be used during those critical times after people get home from work, when they're turning on the TV and the washer and the dryer and making dinner, et cetera, et cetera. You use the battery storage for that. And we've put on more battery storage over the past couple of years than we had before. So go to the Mothers for Peace website. Check our energy expert, his contributions, and you'll see.
Dr. Bird.
No, this is a different expert. His name is Rao Conadina. And he has concluded that we do not need the power from Diablo Canyon.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I'd like people to be aware that the history of Diablo Canyon is a story about earthquake faults. When PG&E first designed the Diablo Canyon plant and started to construct it, it was designed to be built on an area where there were no earthquake faults. PG&E announced there are no earthquake faults within 30 kilometers of this site. Well, they were wrong. The oil industry knew about the Hosgree fault, but PG&E did not. And then soon enough, we discovered the Shoreline fault, the Los Osos fault, a whole bunch of faults around there. And the shoreline is within 600 meters of that plant. So the seismic issue is what started us on this journey, and it is still a very live issue. So that's a big key to why Diablo Canyon is unique. Like, you might like nuclear power. I mean, I don't, but somebody might. Feel free to like nuclear power, but you can't like the plant that's built surrounded by earthquake faults. You cannot. That's a unique situation.
Linda?
The one thing I would like to add is the cost of keeping Diablo Canyon open. PG&E has raised the rates of PG&E customers 6 times during the past year. We have the second highest customer rates of any state except for Hawaii. And Hawaii's coming down because they're going with renewables. And in addition, PG&E reported record profits in 2024. $2.47 billion in profits, shattering the record for the second year in a row. So you and I and all the ratepayers and taxpayers of California are paying to keep this behemoth going. It is tacked on to the rates of people in Southern California and Northern California. And the cost of refurbishing this plant, and we haven't even mentioned the fact that they want to keep it open for another 20 years. So this is a great investment for PG&E. They're making record profits and they're robbing our pocketbooks. And we could do so much better if only our governor and our legislators had the will to turn this around and turn California into a truly renewable state as they had promised us.
Thank you both for joining us and for providing us.
We'll come back anytime.
Yeah, next week.
It will be my pleasure. Thank you, Jane.
Sure.
And thank you, Linda, for joining us. That was Linda Seeley and Jane Swanson, board members of the nonprofit San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, KCSB reporter Mavis Hawley's interview with Megan Overland.
On March 1st, the Santa Barbara Transgender Advocacy Network, SBTAN, organized a march in downtown Santa Barbara. The march included speeches from transgender people, the broader LGBTQ+ community, and allies.
Hi, I'm Megan Overland. I'm with the Santa Barbara Transgender Advocacy Network. We're an organization that provides support for transgender adults as well as parents of transgender children. And recently we held the Transgender Unity March in Santa Barbara.
All right. So to my understanding, the Transgender Unity March was a response to the growing discrimination that transgender people are facing. So furthering this conversation, in the wake of the protest, what is the Transgender Advocacy Network doing to locally combat or support trans people in the face of a LGBTQ+ rights crackdown?
We're going to be doing a bunch of different things. First and foremost, we continue to focus on our core mission and our core programs, which are supporting trans people and transgender families. But we're also realizing that the current climate is calling for more action on the political front. So we're trying to partner with other organizations and get people out and involved. Right now, there are so many people that are looking for that answer. They're asking, what can I do? And we're trying to provide some direction in that, as well as work with other organizations so that we can really find effective ways for people to fight back against everything that's happening.
In partnering with other organizations, would you say a part of that work is amplifying voices? And if you're amplifying voices, what could this potentially mean on a local scale or even a national scale?
Yeah, I think that that's an important thing, because the transgender community, obviously, we're here and we exist and it's a meaningful number of people, but it's still a very small minority. About 1% of the population is transgender. And the reality is that we need allies, we need community support. And so by connecting with other organizations that we align with, we're able to amplify that. That was one of the things that was so reassuring and inspiring from the march on Saturday, was that we had so many allies out, more than 500 people in Santa Barbara there. And so then we're able to get a message out there like, oh, this is important to a lot of people. People care about this. And our elected officials get that message and say, okay, maybe it's important that we take action to protect this community. And around the country, there's so much going on. Obviously, attacks on the transgender community are a big one for us and are important, but there's so much more going on and so many more people being affected. And we need a huge response, and we need everybody to take action and get out there and let people know this isn't okay, and let people know we're going to do something about it, so that on every level, our elected officials, in our courts, in our local governments, our local organizations, and just our neighbors around us know that, like, oh, we understand this is an issue that's important, that these people matter, and that we need to treat people with respect. We need to go back to doing things in a way that protects people's rights and liberty and dignity.
You mentioned bringing in a lot of allies into this conversation. And so I'm curious about how allies can specifically support transgender people. If there's this outpouring of support, how can these people best allocate their resources to help a marginalized community?
I can't say that I know the exact most important thing for everybody to do. There's so much going on right now, and we're all being affected in different ways. What I will say is it's important that we show up and that we keep showing up. For trans organizations, for other organizations, for our community, you know, there are going to be a number of protests, and we need to continue to go out there and not give in to this fatigue. Also, you know, people can give money to organizations. You know, certainly it's like, we're not going to turn away money, but I feel like people are so used to this kind of donation-based democracy of, like, I'm going to donate to my favorite candidate or something. And that's fine if they're doing good work, but we really need people to be involved and engaged. And so find organizations, find community, find groups that are doing things, and take part in that, because that's what we really need. You know, transgender people need a community. They need people supporting them more than we need, you know, any particular amount of money.
So you say community groups are especially important. Yeah. And I know that the Transgender Advocacy Network has a lot of really important community building groups and ways for trans people or trans allies, trans families to connect with one another. So I'm curious to know how your organization is facilitating support for the community overall.
So the first thing I'd say is that our services and the way we are connecting people, for the most part, are through an adult trans group that meets up, and so many people coming out are looking for some sort of support and community. And so if you're an adult trans person, you're somebody that's, you're questioning your gender, you're not really sure, and you're looking for supportive people, for a safe place to talk about that and to work through that, then our organization is someplace you can go. And we have regular meetings in person and online to do that. It's peer support. We also have a lot of socializing available. And likewise, parents. When a parent has a child that comes out as transgender, oftentimes they're not really sure what to do. And so we have a parent group that allows these parents to connect and share resources. And then we also try to connect, of course, with the larger community. So we'll have larger events. We have our Trans Day of Visibility celebration coming up. The Trans Day of Visibility is at the end of March, but our celebration is actually April 5th, and where we invite a larger community and allies to come as well and support our organization, support trans people, meet trans people, see trans art, all of that. I just encourage people to keep going, that things right now are challenging, but this is a time that we need to keep working and push ourselves to do more than we thought we could.
This is Mavis Hawley reporting for KCSB News.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Next, we have another story from KCSB, this one from reporter Rose Friedrich, who interviewed Asian American Studies professor John Park about the history of birthright citizenship.
On President Donald Trump's first day in office, he signed an executive order that proposed ending birthright citizenship for children whose parents are in the U.S. illegally. Though, since then, three federal judges have blocked his order. According to the Associated Press, a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union argued that Trump's order, quote, attempts to append one of the most fundamental American constitutional values, end quote. The Trump administration claims that children of non-citizens are not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, as stated in the 14th Amendment. I talked to UCSB's Asian American Studies professor, Dr. John Park, to shed light on the history of birthright citizenship and the role it will play in the Trump administration's plans.
So can you just tell us what the original purpose and intention was of the 14th Amendment?
Okay, so the 14th Amendment is part of what we, in American legal history, we refer to that as the Second Constitution. And this is the Second Constitution because these amendments were added after the American Civil War. So the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery. The 15th Amendment guarantees the right to vote for people who were formerly enslaved. And the idea behind the 14th Amendment was to guarantee citizenship and equal treatment and due process of law for people who had been formerly enslaved. In the very first Congress of the United States, Congress passed and George Washington signed the Naturalization Act of 1790, which said that only free white persons should be eligible for American citizenship. So in a way, the 14th Amendment was designed specifically to undo those kinds of understandings.
You think the founding fathers were thinking ahead to immigration?
They were concerned about immigration. And certainly in Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and in the very first acts of Congress, like the Naturalization Act, they did envision the United States being populated of inviting immigrants, but they really did envision immigrants from Northwestern Europe, primarily from England, and from these places where those European immigrants would eventually pass as white. And that's why the Naturalization Act of 1790 uses that term white. It's to make sure that the United States, its population, would consist of immigrants who could pass as white.
And in the 1898 U.S. Supreme Court that interpreted the plain meaning of birthright citizenship clause in the landmark case United States versus Wong Kim-ark, how did this case shape our understanding of birthright citizenship?
So the plain language of the 14th Amendment is that all persons born in the United States are American citizens, right? Mm-hmm. So Wong Kim-ark, he's a Chinese American. He was born in San Francisco. He even had a birth certificate. He had abundant evidence that his parents were Chinese merchants in San Francisco, Chinatown. But he was clearly born in the United States. So when he tried to come back after visiting and after being with his parents in China, the white collector of customs, the customs official in San Francisco, acknowledges that he is born in the United States, but because both of his parents are Chinese and because the Chinese have been lawfully excluded from coming to the United States since 1882, for nearly two decades, the United States government had excluded people like him. And so he thought, even if you're born in the United States, you should be excludable as well. So he sues in the federal court. Eventually, it goes to the United States Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court justices, a majority agree that he is a person who's born in the United States, thus he should be regarded as an American citizen. So it's one of those rare cases in the late 19th century where a Chinese litigant actually wins. I mean, that's not that common, right? Mm-hmm. However, in the case itself, the justices say that they're also concerned about the tens of thousands of English, Scottish, Irish, French, German immigrants who are coming to the United States at the same time. And just to refresh your memory, between 1880 and 1920, about 24 million immigrants will come to the United States. There's a huge growth in the American population. So the Supreme Court said that if we say that not everybody born in the United States is an American citizen, it would really disrupt the citizenship claims of all of those tens of thousands of children of European immigrants from being regarded as American citizens. And by comparison, Chinese folk in the late 1890s, it was near impossible to have children, right? After years of exclusion, the number of Chinese American families, very, very tiny compared to the number of Europeans who are forming families and having children. And so the United States Supreme Court did not think that the Chinese American population would ever be very large. The whole thing of the decision would be somewhat inconsequential for them. And then it did really benefit primarily the children of European immigrants.
And do you think this reflects the racial hierarchies and citizenship and immigration?
Yeah, again, I mean, in American history, it clearly fits within that framework of white majorities wanting white immigrants to pass as white American citizens. And just to give you some example or some context, before 1960, persons of Asian ancestry in the United States were less than 1% of the American population of the United States. It's not until after 1965 that considerable numbers of non-white immigrants come to the U.S., right? And these include immigrants not just from Asia, but from Mexico and from Central America. And this is where states like California, between 1970 and 1990, California went from being a predominantly white state to being a state that the white folk were a minority. I think there are many people, when they look at those trends, they just don't like those trends.
Yeah.
Even that phrase, make America great again, I guess for some people, that might be before 1970, when all political majorities were white political majorities. Yeah. I think that's in part where some of this Trumpiness comes in, and you know, Trump's executive orders about birthright citizenship. I think he and other supporters of that rule know primarily it's not European folk who are going to suffer. It's going to be people of color. And for two decades, I think Republicans and many more conservative folk in the United States have disliked how so many people of color are not just coming to the United States, they're passing into American citizenship. And I think the executive order comes from that direction.
When defending birthright citizenship, what lessons can we take from the Wong Kim Ark case?
In a way, the birthright citizenship clause, the 13th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, these rules embody what we might call an anti-caste principle. Like, no one should be legally disabled under the law, right? We should all have the right to vote. We should all have the right to participate. The current administration, I think, is attacking that principle. And if the current administration gets what it wants, many more hundreds of thousands of people are legally not going to have the right to participate. And they are not going to have the right to vote. They're not going to be regarded as fellow American citizens. To have so many people, millions of people, who are neighbors and people that we see all every day, that they don't get to vote, that they don't get to participate fully, that is a huge problem.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
That was KCSB reporter Rose Friedrich speaking with Asian American Studies professor John Park. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today, or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.